It's very important to a social scientist. I think the definition of social science, which is important for all students to remember, is social science is history with the events left out. The world is made up of events. What happens, happens. You get, if you have Marine Le Pen elected, you had Donald Trump elected. It's an event. It changed Erdogan 2 days ago. It's going to change the course of events. And you can have social explanations, social forces, class forces, and so forth. But we need to concentrate on events. And particularly the advantage, I believe, studying the history of political thought for understanding the contemporary world is that historians of political theory, political thought, necessarily read classics such as Thucydides, from Thucydides to Hobbes to Tocqueville and so forth. Individuals who are very sensitive to Machiavelli, the way political actors behave, even in context where state institutions have collapsed. Because we are in a period of the dissolving or unraveling of the institutional structures in which we've lived since the Second World War, students of who have large vistas and large horizons of historical experience, who don't believe that that monarchy, for example, is an anomalous political system, because of course monarchy is the most common political system in human history. So it would behoove us to study the monarchy in our schools of social science, something we do not do, as you know. So I do think that a wider historical understanding, wider historical vistas, can help us respond more with less panic and less disorientation to this new age which we are now facing of considerable political confusion. Well, the traditional laws of war, codified really for the first time in the 19th century, developed under conditions of symmetrical war, where you had two armies fighting each other, in which the soldiers on both sides were innocent. That is, they were not guilty for fighting for their side. On the contrary, it was their duty to fight for their side. And this is, of course, very different from the War on Terror, where the entire enemy army is made up of so-called, or whatever, the individuals are considered war criminals. So it's very, very different. Second, symmetrical war and the laws of war develop very much in a context with the expectation that after war there will be peace. Many of the inhibitions on soldiers, on the way soldiers behave in war, derive from the expectation that the war will end and the nations that were at one point belligerent will live together in peace. This obviously also is irrelevant to the War on Terror. There's no expectation that the Western countries are going to live in peace with the members of ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So there is a very strong break and the inability of the laws of war to seriously regulate counterterrorism derives in part from the fact that these two conditions under which the laws of war arose are missing. So I think I want to frame this in the context of the question of whether liberalism, classical liberalism from Locke to John Stuart Mill, Montesquieu, and so forth, Benjamin Constant, whether liberalism understood in that way provides an adequate framework for dealing with terrorism as we understand it today, particularly radical Salafi terrorism. And it is possible, if you look as a historian of ideas would do, to the origins of liberalism in religious civil war, to conclude that in fact it's not just probable, but it's certain that liberalism was originally crafted, designed, was a response to religious violence, religious-inspired violence, and an attempt to reduce particularly mimetic violence. In general, my understanding of liberalism does not focus on unregulated markets and individual consumerism and so forth, but on the basic challenge to human society, which is mimetic violence. That is, when you or some member of your group hurts a member of my group, I am driven, it's a hardwired into human nature, that I attack your group, and I do so in a way that I think is proportional, but which you see as excessive. And then a spiral of violence occurs. This kind of flame, the flames of mimetic violence, or cycles of revenge, easily overtake and destroy societies from within. And political development, including state building of all forms, relies upon different mechanisms for reducing mimetic violence, including Wehrgeld and using money to avoid revenge and other things. But liberalism itself has, I think, in essence, been fundamentally designed to reduce spirals of violence by focusing on the individual culpable for the act, as opposed to his kinship group or his community or his nation or his race. And I think one of the great mistakes, I would say, or the great fallacies behind the American response to 9/11 in particular, was to accept bin Laden's invitation to join a spiral of violence and to attack not those who perpetrated the crime, those who organized the crime, those who gave logistical support to the crime, but attack some kind of vague community that was responsible for injuring us in this way. And that decision to choose, I would call mimetic violence, expressive violence, a violence that makes us feel strong again, not just a victim, which is very expressive, rather than thinking through the obvious consequences of overkill, which is excessive collateral damage, and inaccurate targeting, mistaken identity killings, and particularly the killings of civilians who are not really involved in the original act. That, of course, produces more violence. So, in a sense, the main lesson of liberalism, which is how to discipline violence so that it doesn't produce more violence, has been lost in the war on terror. And one of the ways it was lost is an attempt to apply the category of war to the category of counterterrorism. And this is very misleading, and I think shows the failure to understand the contribution that liberalism can make to fighting terrorism, because liberalism has, I think, one of its central categories in crime fighting, the presumption of innocence. Presumption of innocence means that if I have to prove in an adversarial setting, or I have to give evidence, I have to give arguments to show that you've done something wrong. Now, obviously, in war, there is a presumption of innocence. The soldiers are innocent, but you can kill them. Not only are you allowed to, but you are commanded to kill them. So the presumption of innocence puts no limit on the use of violence in war, which is why the category war is so destructive for dealing with a group of radical fanatics whose main desire is to have us indiscriminately attack their communities and therefore produce more recruits to their crazy cause. So terrorism is obviously sui generis. It's neither crime nor war. It's not war because it's not an armed conflict between nation states, which is war. And it's not crime because, ordinarily a bank robber doesn't blow himself up in order to inspire other bank robbers. So it's something particular. And criminal law, of course, is not exactly adequate. However, there are certain principles that are, I think, essential and encoded in the liberal criminal justice systems of Western countries that are quite relevant. And the two most important are the one I just mentioned, the individualization of culpability, going after the individuals, making sure you don't radicalize fence-sitting members of the community by conveying the message that those who have done nothing are going to be killed anyway, which you can do with these indiscriminate drone attacks and so forth. And second, and also equally important, which is essential to my understanding of liberalism, as a political doctrine that cannot be reduced to individualism of market, unregulated markets, and so on. And that is the necessity of sanity checks on government decision making. So a liberal government is one that's designed in the following ways, so that the decision to use force has to be made in the context, a rationale, a justification for using force has to be given to an independent tribunal that has the power to say no, that has the power to criticize, that has the power to ask for evidence. If the government is excused from giving reasons for its use of violence, it will soon have very few reasons. It will soon be doing things that are in fact productive of more violence, that actually produce the spirals of violence that I was just talking about. So liberalism, by its institutional structures, which are the criminal trial or the legislative oversight of executive action, other institutional forms that enforce obligatory reason giving on the part of the government. We have to be realistic here. This isn't a perfect solution, but it does push in the direction of sanity checks on government use of force, and tends to reduce the amount of indiscriminate force being used, which is something that the armed wing of the state bureaucracy, left to its own adrenaline, is not likely to do. So I think in this sense, you can see the difference between crime fighting and war fighting this way. It's very tempting for a military unit, if there is a very important terrorist in a building, to simply blow up the building, regardless of who is in the building. Now, a police department is not going to blow up a building killing civilians just because there's a drug lord in there. They won't do it. Why? Because the police have, through time, understood and have been regulated on the ground that the most important source of police power is open communication with the community. And it can't behave in a way that arbitrarily abuses the community if it wants information from the community about malefactors and criminals. Now, you would think that that has obvious relevance to the war on terror, because terrorists are often hidden within communities, and you obviously need to make sure that information is coming from the community, people who are snitches or giving you information about them. And therefore, you should use this principle of not chemotherapy, which is killing in healthy cells in order to get the one disease cell, but very strong prejudice against overkill and collateral damage on the grounds that you need cooperative relations with the community. Now, war doesn't tend to do that. The basic idea in war is that the enemy is, they're all wearing uniforms, and you can kill all of them. You're not dealing with the civilians. And the only source of limit, there is a principle in the laws of war to, it's called the principle of distinction, which instructs soldiers not to kill civilians or not to target civilians purposely. But you have to understand the origin of that principle to see why it's not relevant and doesn't apply in the war on terror. The origin is not that the innocent civilians had a great lobbying power and were able to incorporate their interests in the laws of war. The laws of war were written by chiefs of staff and general staffs, military authorities. Why would they make a distinction between civilians and soldiers? The answer is that their soldiers, if they have a choice between running into the guns and bayonets of an armed enemy who wants to kill them, rather than going into a city where they can rape the women and steal, because they're going to do the thing that's safest for them and most attractive. And their officers can't let them do that. So they make it a very strong criminal violation, including leading to execution, to waste ammo on civilians as opposed to facing the enemy. Now, that rationale, which is a rationale of order and discipline, not a rationale of human rights of the sufferers, does not apply in air combat, because the guys in the airplanes can't steal and rape, so they're not tempted to do that. And it doesn't apply in terrorism cases, because these guys are they're injected into a context such as we just saw now in the mountains of Afghanistan, where the enemy is a group of criminals who deserve no quarter. I want to talk about both the anti-liberal zeitgeist today, and the collapse of international order. The evolution of counterterrorism toward policies which are classically illiberal or anti-liberal, such as reduced procedural guarantees for those who are accused of committing heinous crimes, which is a very illiberal idea because you have to establish that they committed the crime before you could reduce their procedures. And second, punishing people for crimes they may commit in the future, or using the criminal law to prevent people who are innocent of crimes thus far from committing crimes that you suspect they may commit. Now, those are two very anti-liberal policies, which we see everywhere, including in France, the second one, certainly, preventive detention. And in general, there's this tendency. Now, it fits into what I would say is the general loss of credibility of liberalism, of post-war liberalism, deriving from the fact that the open economy, which is a very important liberal value, is associated inextricably with open demography. And today, I think the source of cultural anxieties from which illiberal politics springs come from the source of illiberal anxieties reflect a fusion of the two threats: terrorism on the one hand, infiltrator terrorists underground who may attack you, you know, Bataclan or blowing up subways and so forth, and the threat to identity from immigrants. And somehow they get fused in a very unclear, irrational, sub-rational way to produce a sense that our order cannot hold. And liberalism, unfortunately, has traditionally been associated with principles such as toleration, which seems more like today an advantage for employers who want low-skilled workers and middle-class women who want house cleaners. So toleration becomes associated with a class bias, with the idea of course, open borders, as I said, which seems to be, liberalism is pretty comfortable with restricting the flow of goods. You can have tariffs are a completely liberal principle, but the free flow of peoples is something that liberalism has a hard time finding a reasonable objection to. While nationalists, chauvinists, communitarian identity politicians have a much stronger argument there, which is they're not us. We want to, the basic illiberal line that you hear everywhere is it's not our country anymore because others are sneaking in. And in the US, it's the idea that we're a white lump of sugar being dissolved in a black cup of coffee and we're going to lose our nature, our contours, our self in some way. Now, why that's related to terrorism, it's not, I think, unclear. But I think that's a sense of threat that is making it hard for liberals to defend open borders and the world, which is, in effect, made dangerous by the amazing technological achievements of our society: cheap airline tickets, GPS, ATM, all things which terrorists can use to hurt us. The open society is permeable and vulnerable. So we can't close those off. You can't close them off. Therefore, we have to learn how to manage. And that's another reason why we should deal with terrorism as a form of crime, because criminal law has centuries, millennia of practice of dealing with a threat of violence that will not go away. So it's more like terrorism than war is like terrorism. Now, the international order, I agree, is very much in question today. NATO, the European Union, you have three candidates in France running for the presidency. The election hasn't yet happened today, which is April 18th, 2017. Three of them are anti-European and vaguely pro-Putin, which is extremely bizarre. However, it does mirror very exactly the policy of Donald Trump, as far as we know. So that shows you that there is, an anti-liberal zeitgeist abroad in the world. And from the point of view of Trump, there's nothing more disturbing than the European Union, because a trading bloc or an internationally organized trading system makes it much harder to bully and domineer. In order to bully and domineer in international trade, you need bilateral relations. So he's devoted to turning the clock back, bringing us back to a time where trading relations were bilateral, because that's a place where you can bully and dominate. And as we know from the history of the 20th century, bullying and domination in foreign bilateral trade is a source of world conflagration. So I'm very worried that the liberal commitment to international economic multilateral cooperation is being weakened along with the commitment to liberal principles in fields such as counterterrorism.